You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. It's become easy to find examples of failed leadership. You don't have to look any further than the big three American automakers, the country's largest banks and insurance companies, or the New Jersey politicians arrested last month on corruption charges. In his latest book, Leading the Charge, retired General Tony Zinni looks at why so many businesses and government leaders don't seem to be living up to expectations and offers suggestions for getting our leadership back on track. General Zinni was Commander-in-Chief of CENTCOM and has served as Special Envoy to the Middle East. He's written the book with his frequent collaborator, Tony Koltz. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. And I'm pleased it brings him back to the Leonard Lopate Show. Sorry, General. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jonathan. Thank you.
Good. Before we talk about your book, can I get you to ask you your reaction to yesterday's big announcement by Attorney General Holder about looking into past abuses by CIA officers, that those abuses would be investigated?
Right. Well, I think it's important for us to understand what happened. And I think, obviously, if there's something that was illegal, broke the laws, obviously there has to be some degree of accountability and responsibility. I don't think that issues that don't deal with law and pursuit of people at the other end who were told things were legal is that effective. I agree with the president that much of this we need to get behind us. But I don't think it's healthy for us to have these things happen and us not understand what happened, how they happened, and then certainly the accountability issue being dealt with.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you hear people saying is that the investigation, or should investigators go all the way up the chain and potentially hold, say, former Vice President Cheney accountable for what happened? Do you think that it should go that high?
Well, I think obviously the Attorney General's office has to first see, what laws were involved here, what may have been broken. If there was an interpretation of the laws that were issues, the issue, then we have to see who made those interpretations and why. I think that's the first order of business. And then see where it takes us. I wouldn't be in favor of witch hunts for political purposes. I don't think that's useful. But I do think, again, that the letter of the law and accountability on the law is critical because we're a nation of laws. I mean, the very concept of our nation is based on the Constitution, which in effect is a law.
Mm-hmm. And how damaging do you think the abuses that have already come to light, how damaging have they been to America's standing in the world and potentially to America's national security?
I think they've been very damaging to our reputation and disappointing to our allies. Those that are our enemies want to find ways for us to compromise our values and our belief systems. It serves their purposes to demonstrate in their minds that we're the great Satan, a corrupt society. And so when things like this happens, it adds credence to that. Unfortunately, people don't see that these are usually aberrations. That, certainly when you look at Abu Ghraib and other things, mm-hmm. the vast majority of our troops out there that were conducting themselves appropriately and honorably, that gets pushed aside by a few that may commit these sorts of violations of our own law and sets of values. So I think there is good in getting it out and finding out what went wrong and doing it in a public way. That's the way we repair any damage done to our reputation and our image.
My last question on this, do you think the United States can regain its reputation, or is it irreparably damaged?
No, we will regain it. I mean, we have to put this in context. Almost every war we've had, there's been from the Japanese internment in World War II, waiver of habeas corpus. I mean, World War I, the Civil War, all the way back to the Alien and Sedition Acts. There have been moments in our history when maybe we've done things because of the pressure of the times and the threat have led us to do things that when we look back in retrospect, we regretted and learned from it. And this will be another lesson. And I mean, the strength of America is not that she never makes a mistake. It's that we learn from our mistakes and we recover from them. And unlike others, we are honest and open about what may have been done that shouldn't have been done.
Mm-hmm. All right. So now let's talk about your book. Okay. What inspired you to write a book about leadership?
The previous book I wrote a few years ago dealt with how the world had changed since the fall of the Soviet Union, different power structures, globalization, information technology, migrations that were changing, identity issues, non-state actors. And I really was impressed that we weren't getting it. We didn't understand this new world. We were still operating under old Cold War models. And when I talked about this as I went around discussing the book, I kept getting, audience comments about leadership that okay, if this is so and we believe it's so, our leadership's failing us. Don't we have to relook at the way we lead, maybe understand leadership in a different way? My first response was no, leadership principles are timeless and the qualities are timeless. But as I heard more and more, I decided to look at this more deeply. I realized by research that, for example, the American people last year, 77% felt we had a leadership crisis, and it was in every aspect of society. Not one aspect of society did the leadership rise above 50% approval rating. And so I said, well, some people must be doing it right. And I found that leaders getting it right in a very confused environment now had certain qualities. So what I mentioned in the book is about 11 things that I found were unique to the successful leaders, General David Petraeus, Richard Branson in the airline industry. Why does the leadership in Toyota and Honda get it right when the three American car companies don't seem to get it right? And so the leadership I found, big and small, there were distinctive qualities or skill sets that they seemed mm-hmm. to have that differentiated them from the rest of the pack.
Now, you said there were 11 of them that you,
right.
you saw. So let me ask you then, how many of the 11 do you say President Obama has or exhibits?
Well, I think there's certain personal qualities that certainly exhibits. He's a great communicator. He has empathy with people and connects well. Charismatic. That seems to be a trait you often see. He's seems to be decisive. We saw his actions on the economy and the actions he took that mark him as a decisive individual. I think there are other areas that have yet to be proven successful or not successful. One of the things I mentioned is the ability to be imaginative in how you organize what you lead. This sort of team of rivals and these sets of czars and special advisors or super envoys that he's created, that's an interesting and different structure. There's a lot of controversy over that. And,
I was going to ask
and
you, well,
we'll
what
see
you,
how that pans out.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what do you make of that? Does that say that he's a strong leader because he can delegate very important and major tasks to someone else, or is it a deflection of necessary duties?
Well, I think he is a delegator by nature. I think you would not have had a team of strong rivals and strong egos if he didn't feel confident that he could delegate. I think there are other structural issues. I mean, you have to give him credit for being creative in some of these instances, but there are deeper questions that can come about. For example, many of these posts that are created are not confirmed by the Senate, and they have authority in some cases over confirmable positions. And so now it presents an issue of constitutionality, perhaps. It's extra to the structure. Instead of changing the structure, they're sort of overlaid on the structure, and that can create confusion in terms of lines of authority. So the jury's still out. Obviously, it's only a little more than 200 days. We'll see how this works, particularly in the area of foreign policy, where most of these have the greatest impact, but in other areas also.
Mm-hmm. So there's long been disagreement over whether great leaders are born or if they can be made. Can leadership be taught?
Oh, absolutely. I think we develop leaders. You know, the last century was the leadership century, because probably by the beginning of the 20th century, we were the global society was having to make leaders from the masses. I mean, the idea of aristocracy or royal blood or an elite group, obviously assuming leadership by birth, right, that was gone. And so we had to understand how to make leaders. And through trial and error and great experience, we've come through several, I guess, evolutionary periods in how we develop leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting pretty good at it in some cases. The military, obviously, now the corporate world is learning how to build leaders in our universities and colleges. And, you know, we're doing more work in leader development. There's a big investment made by corporations in extensive leader development programs. I've taught leadership at several universities, and I've consulted on leadership for several large corporations, mm-hmm. and built programs. So mm-hmm. we're still learning in this business, but I do believe you can develop leaders. Now, sometimes you come with some natural skills, the ability to communicate, sort of a charismatic mm-hmm. nature, some degree of intuition and creativity that actually make you maybe ahead of the game. But it doesn't mean that you can't make leaders out of most people.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and we're speaking with General Tony Zinni about his new book, Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. So you were a troop commander. So was yes. it obvious to you immediately which soldiers would move on to become leaders and which would remain followers?
No, I think you get surprised often. I mean, history is replete with examples where there's a crisis or a significant traumatic moment in an organization, and suddenly a leader rises from the ranks, so to speak. I think in general you can make some determinations about people's potential, but you should be open to all possibilities of leaders rising from the ranks that you haven't expected, where the event may present the opportunity for them to demonstrate their leadership ability, and I think it's a good idea not to have any sort of a supposed ideas about what makes great leaders, because you do make them in the end, and you do help make them, and all sorts of different personalities and characteristics can be successful. You have to teach people how to play to their strengths and how to overcome and work on their limitations. And we're becoming more, I think, savvy about all that lately.
Mm-hmm. You've pointed out that we're living at a time when every child who plays on a sports team gets a trophy. So do leaders need to work differently with young people who've grown up being praised for their efforts rather than for their achievements?
I really believe we do. I think you could create a false sense of self-confidence by not having young people understand what it takes to be successful. And we can learn from times when we're not successful. We learn from our mistakes, and we learn from the times we fail or we lose the game, just like we should learn from the times we win. We may learn more from the times we lose. But without all that experience, I think you create this false sense of self-confidence, expectations, and that's going to lead to disappointment in the end, because the world, no matter what it is, whether it's national security or it's in the corporate world or anything else, is very competitive, and you have to learn how to compete. Hopefully you learn how to compete in a fair and ethical way, and you learn how to develop the kind of skills and the quality of whatever it is you do, the services you provide, the products you produce that make you competitive. But without that, believing that it's going to come your way no matter what would, I think, harm leaders in the long run, because it's not reality.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with retired General Tony Zinni about his book, Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan, and we'll have more after a break. I'm Jonathan Capehart, here today for Leonard Lopate, and we're speaking with retired General Tony Zinni about his new book, Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. So let me ask you this, General. What's the difference, do you think, between working with, say, the greatest generation and working with them and training them and Generation X?
Well, I think, and I make this point in my book, there's six generations in the workforce, if you will, starting with mine, which is a pre-baby boomer generation, all the way down to Gen X and now Gen Y and a new generation coming out of our high schools and universities. Every one of them are unique in many ways. That's why they get named. And the kind of leadership you have to exert now has to appreciate that sort of, my term, vertical diversity that you have in the workforce, because what formed each of us in our generation were the conditions that our parents went through, the world that we lived through. If you went through the Second World War era or the Cold War era, or your parents did, it formed you in many ways. And so there has to be an appreciation for these. Just as an example, I use this example in my book. A friend of mine who works at a very large mutual fund company had to prepare an incentives program or a rewards program for his employees. And when tasked to do that, he polled the employees as to how they wanted to be rewarded for exceptional performance. The older employees wanted it in their paycheck. The younger employees wanted recognition. They wanted that plaque, or they wanted that handshake in the office of the CEO with some sort of a certificate or something to hang on the wall. And it meant more to them than just a pay. I mean, obviously, it's nice that you get a raise too, but of equal importance was that recognition. So there are many things like that that mark different generations, and I think you have to be a leader for all those generations, just like you have to lead the diversity in race, gender, and other issues we face in our society. In now a very diverse, organization, almost in every field that you encounter.
Yeah, I just want to be clear on something. So the greatest generation, or generations before Generation X, they wanted the recognition in their paychecks. Generation X and younger, they're looking for the recognition, the certificate, the handshake with the CEO, but they still want the recognition in the paycheck. Also,
well,
they want the plaque
in
the paper in addition to.
Yeah, I would say certainly that they'd like to see the pay raise. If probably there was less of a raise with the recognition, that might be more how it pans out. And I that shouldn't be taken to mean the older generation was more mercenary in some way. I really attribute it to the idea that, since I'm not far removed from that generation, I was part of that generation, really. We grew up with parents that lived through the Depression and through some hard times, and we're interested in security. I mean, we're very focused on personal security, financial security. It's the environment we grew up in, and we're generations that haven't had to face that. They may not be as sort of focused on that. So it's not necessarily a mercenary or a material angle. People could make the case, certainly, that Generation X now, which is probably a middle generation, was more oriented to personal things than others. But I think each generation is culturally brought up in a way that marks them and identifies them, and you just have to understand, where they're coming from and what that did to form their ideas and their sort of values.
And would you say that Generation X is, say, generally more willing to take risks and travel than their older counterparts?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they'll move in a heartbeat. And again, I go back to the issue of security. Job security is key to older generations that had, again, the Depression-era parents, times when unemployment was high. And so they may not take as many risks to ensure job security, where maybe a younger person is willing to take the risk to leave a decent job because they seek something else. There's something else they want to try in life. So they may be more adventuresome and greater risk takers in older generations.
Now, how about does that risk-taking gene in Generation X, does that pose problems in a military environment when you need unit cohesion and stability and order?
No, I don't think so. I don't think you see it in a military organization. In many ways, the younger generations, which are much more engaged and want to be heard, if you learn to harness that, and there's more participatory involvement in what's going on. There's still a clear line of authority and who makes decisions, but now you're seeing, even in the military, much more involvement of the organization, trying to get all people involved into the process of decision-making, providing the information, providing inputs, providing opinions. You know, you want the opinion from the factory floor as much as you want the opinion from the offices above it, because without both sides and understanding it fully, you don't make the best decisions in the end. And of course, younger generations expect to be part of that. They want to be involved. They want a sense of participation and representation in what they do. And so, in a way, that's a good thing. Now, in the business world, obviously, it presents some challenges. One is retention. If you have really good people, they're highly marketable. They know it. And if they're willing to move and take risk, you've got to do more to ensure that that you're fulfilling the needs that they have and meeting their requirements. Mm-hmm. The idea that they're not going to leap off this lily pad and jump onto the next one because of the security issue won't be the same. So retention becomes a challenge in most places, and mm-hmm. and how that they feel fulfilled and actualized in some way in what they're doing.
Let's talk about leadership failure. And one leadership failure you've written about in this book, as well as in your earlier books, concerned the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. Can you talk about some of the leadership mistakes that were made in planning and executing that invasion?
Well, you know, there are a number of them. You know, obviously, I think it's loss of focus. After 9/11, we knew who perpetrated the act. We knew where they were. And we allowed ourselves to be distracted by the business in Iraq. And we can see now in Afghanistan, with al-Qaeda still in existence and still threatening us, and the problems that presents in Pakistan and Afghanistan, how it's been allowed to fester because of our loss of focus and distraction. Secondly, the mistakes we made in understanding what we were getting involved in Iraq. You remember the flowers in the streets, cakewalk, you know, anybody that knew that
liberators.
That was not the case. Anybody that had been there for a while understood it. Third was to believe we could do something like that on the cheap. You know, remember, the oil was going to pay for it all, and we can do it with far less troops. The plans that were in existence had called for 300,000-400,000 troops, which I happen to be the author of them. Those, you know, and General Shinseki had voiced his concerns, dismissed out of hand by the leadership. And fourth, the way the intelligence was treated, the sort of cherry-picking what you wanted to hear, justifying a decision with cherry-picked intelligence instead of taking an honest look and maybe more of an open look against involving those that may be against or opposed to understand the rationale. You know, so, and then on the ground, a whole series of decisions that were wrong for the environment, dismantling the Iraqi regular military, debathifying to the point that you alienated a segment of the society instead of reconciling it, closing state-owned factories and putting people out of work initially. I mean, a whole series of poor decisions made in that. So all of us that could see this coming and understood that environment and that world, since we had spent decades in it, you know, voiced our concerns.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to that, but I have to say, I'm Jonathan Capehart sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and this is the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. And you're listening to General Tony Zinni about his new book. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is, you know, you, as you said, were one of the authors of the memos saying we need a lot of troops to go into Iraq. And General Shinseki was one of those people who, you know, said, hey, we got to do this as well. And he was ostracized. If you're in the military and you see something or a decision that's being made that you know isn't the right call, how do you speak up and exert, I would say, a leadership stance in an environment that demands order and where something like that would be considered insubordination, perhaps?
Well, you certainly don't become insubordinate. You voice your concerns within the system to your seniors and your political masters in that. If they don't heed it or you feel it's that drastic, your only alternative is to then resign or retire and speak from without. I mean, we've had lessons in the past. MacArthur did it the wrong way. General Singlob over the Korean issue with President Carter did it the wrong way. You cannot take opposition to policy in uniform. If you feel that strongly, you have to leave the service and then speak as a private citizen about your concerns. Now, I will say that, you know, when I was on active duty as the commander of CENTCOM, my boss, who was Secretary of Defense Bill Cohen, ensured that we had a voice. He wanted to hear, even if we disagreed with administration policy, our views. And within the system, he ensured that our voice, even if he didn't agree with us, went up to the senior political leadership. He took me to see President Clinton several times, took me to see the leadership in the Senate and House when I disagree with policy issues. I felt satisfied in some cases. Decisions were changed as a result of that. Some cases they weren't, but I felt I had a fair hearing, and that my concerns were taken into account. You know, when you have an environment where they're not welcome and that access and that difference isn't provided, then I think it becomes a problem, mm-hmm. and then the military leadership has to make a decision. But there's only one decision if it's going to be public, and that is you must leave. You must take the uniform off if you're going to do that.
Now, you anticipated that Iraq would need a great deal of support to rebuild and reestablish order after Saddam Hussein was removed from power, right? That's correct.
That's right.
Yeah. So then one, how did you come to those conclusions? And two, how is it that, say, Vice President Dick Cheney and former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld couldn't see that, didn't heed your prognostications?
Well, I saw it from several sources. I mean, first of all, I'd been involved in that part of the world for, you know, almost a decade and a half at that point, and I saw it firsthand. We had friends in the region that knew the inner workings of Iraq society very closely and advised me on this. And then I had the advice of our own intelligence organizations. I mean, right before I left active duty in 2000, the intelligence community was telling me what to expect. They were using terms like a very, very fragile society that will come apart, that ethnic and religious hatreds are just below the surface and will explode if they're not managed, that there are problems that will come across the borders and into a chaotic Iraq. This wasn't, you know, my invention. This was given to me by very astute intelligence professionals and friends in the region who knew it well. And it went into our planning in terms of numbers of troops and what we had to accomplish once we went in. I mean, for example, we knew we had to seal the borders, control the population as we rolled back the authority of the Saddam regime, because obviously those ethnic and religious hatreds could come to the surface and be disruptive. We had to prevent looting. We had to maintain order. We had to keep organizations like the regular military and the factories and things in being and working, you know, keep the society functioning. I mean, it didn't take rocket science to figure this all mm-hmm. out.
You know, one thing you just, by your description there, the intelligence community was on top of it. They gave you lots of great information that went into your planning. So then how do you square the fact that yet they got it so wrong on weapons of mass destruction?
Well, I mean, it's difficult for me to understand because I followed the weapons of mass mm-hmm. destruction program, you know, through my time in the service and even afterwards. I did some work on that with one of our intelligence services. And I watched it as we learned more. I mean, certainly when I was on active duty, especially in the early years in CENTCOM, I believe certainly that Saddam had a capability, as the inspectors did. As the inspectors did their work and dismantled much of that, and obviously were the accountability of what had been there became more accurate. You know, after I retired and saw the intelligence, there was absolutely no evidence of an ongoing program. Certainly, he could have restarted one. He had dual-use facilities. The scientists were still there. If you recall that the inspectors, when they came back in after Secretary Powell went to the UN and got the resolution to reinstate them, they were trying to get the scientists out of the country to talk more to them, to get them out with their families. But there was no clear evidence of an ongoing program, and the things like the yellow cake and the aluminum tubes mm-hmm. and these weather balloons that were, I mean, no one, they did not have the credibility and the reliability from the sources of being a clear smoking gun in any way. So it baffled me that the certainty with which the intelligence was used to confirm a program totally baffled me because I didn't see it anywhere in there. It just wasn't there. And statements being made, like the former vice president said, that Saddam was amassing weapons of mass destruction along his borders to use on his neighbors. I mean, ridiculous. We controlled the airspace. We could see everything that went on. And if he was amassing these so-called weapons, we couldn't even point to one and show it in a demonstrable way that everybody could clearly see he had it, and with the inspectors in at the time.
So we're running out of time, but I want to ask you about sort of long-term thinking. Do you think that today's leaders have lost their ability to look and plan ahead? And do you have any idea what's contributed to this lack of vision?
Yeah, I do. I think there's certainly an absence of the kind of quality strategic thinking, a future orientation, a visionary approach to things, whether it's business or governance or whatever. We seem to be day-to-day managers. You know, tactics has superseded strategy. And we think back to the George Marshalls and Kennans and others that looked at how we structure ourselves for a future that they could very cleverly and astutely ascertain we faced, as in the case of the coming Cold War, when the creation of NATO and the Marshall Plan and the restructuring of the government, 1947 National Security Act. We don't have that kind of thinking now. I mean, the question you hear all the time is, where are the Marshalls? And I believe it's sort of a product of a society that's overwhelmed with information technology. We're constantly receiving data and communicating now, whether it's cell phones or it's texting or it's laptops or whatever it is. And so the time to think, the time to process what we're getting, which is really rich because of the volume of information and data we get, but to process that and think about how it affects us and how we prepare ourselves for the future, that time is sort of absent from our lives. And the value on that kind of strategic thinking and future orientation has not been there. And we're paying a price for that in business, in governance, in almost every aspect of society.
General Zinni, and I should point out that he's a four-star general, not just, you know, regular general. Four stars. We've got less than a minute left. You and your book, with some advice to young men and women who hope to become successful leaders, can you sum up for us some of your most important messages real fast?
Yeah, I would say there's three things. One, be super competent. Never stop learning. The second thing is really take care of your people. Your people and the people you serve, whether it's your customers or your stakeholders or whatever. And the third is make sure you have a personal code that's based on a value system and an ethical system that you can be proud of.
Do you think that this new generation, does it have a personal code?
It's more difficult because the institutions that used to give it to us, family, some sort of faith institution, our schools, they aren't necessarily providing that sort of foundation and code now.
I've been speaking with retired General Tony Zinni about his book, Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom, which is published by Palgrave Macmillan. General, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jonathan.